National Gallery podcast.
Hello, I'm Miranda Hinckley, and over the next 15 minutes, I'll be bringing you this month's news from the National Gallery, London. Coming up, passionate and obsessive, words that could describe contemporary British artist Leon Kossoff. We'll be treating you to a sneak preview of his new exhibition inspired by half a century's visits to the gallery's collection. And
they are unbelievably easy to grow. They're unbelievably generous of flower. And they're really very, they don't get pests and diseases. You know, they're terribly easy.
As visitors to Renoir Landscapes will have seen, Renoir loved painting dahlias. We talk to garden expert Sarah Raven about her own passion for these dazzling blooms and discover how to recreate the Renoir effect for ourselves. We'll also take a closer look at our permanent collection to explore a concept that's fascinated artists and viewers throughout history, beauty. But first, Leon Kossoff has long been famous for his densely worked oil paintings of contemporary London, but as our new exhibition reveals, much of his work's been inspired by his intense study of the National Gallery collection. Kossoff's been coming here to draw the paintings since his student days in the 1950s, often returning to the same pictures time and again. To discuss his obsession with the collection, Colin Wiggins, Deputy Head of Education, met artist and long-term collaborator on Kossoff's prints, Anne Dowker. The show was being installed, rather noisily, as they spoke in the gallery.
This is a subject that Leon has painted I don't know how many times. It's a very important subject to him. It represents Nicholas Hawksmoor's church in the East End of London, Christchurch Spitalfields, which is the area of London where he had his childhood. So it's a very familiar building to him. And it's the area of London as well where his family settled. His family, who were Ukrainian Jews, moved to London at the beginning of the 20th century. So it's like his real home patch. And this picture is perhaps the one that's most responsible for this exhibition happening, because it was hanging in a small back room at Kossoff's studio next to the drawing that we've put on the wall alongside it, which is a drawing made from Poussin, Cephalus and Aurora. And the drawing and the painting seem to share the same kind of energy, the same kind of weather conditions, if you like.
So the arc of the tree responds to the arc of the tree there.
Yes, that's even though they're different mediums and different scales, the energy seems to skip across the wall between the painting and the drawing, and you see they're about the same thing. That the little figures in Poussin's painting, who are of course mythological figures, connect with the little figures sitting at the base of the church, who are in fact, you could almost see them as modern mythological figures, because they represent all the winos and the dossers and the homeless people that tend to congregate around the big city churches. Now also on this wall there's Kossoff's response to Rembrandt's little Ecce Homo, which is a painting showing Christ presented to the people with Pontius Pilate, the famous New Testament scene. And we've got a drawing and a print, and this time a painting. And the way that he works on the paintings is that he will make a new drawing from Rembrandt's painting in the National Gallery, take those drawings home, and use them as the springboard, as it were, to start work on his own painted response. And the painted response, which was finished in the late 1990s, is a painting that, in Kossoff's own words, he describes it as emerging after 50 years of being aware of Rembrandt's picture.
And also have some kind of contact, as he would feel, with Rembrandt.
Yeah. It's like keeping a love affair going for 50 years. That's what it is. Like keeping that freshness and that spontaneity going within each image. And that's why I think the work communicates that energy and that freshness. Even though some of the most recent things, he's in his late 70s when he's making them, but they've still got that excitement, that sense of thrill, yeah, of an encounter with a great painting.
Like his original intention of coming in being thrilled and excited by what he sees, it's never gone away. He's retained that constantly.
The best way to become familiar, to really get to understand an old master painting, is not to read a book or read the label or listen to a lecture. It's actually to sit in front of it and draw it.
It's through the process of drawing, you begin to possess the painting, and it becomes your painting. And I think once you start drawing from paintings, you find it very difficult just to look. You really, really just want to record it, to put it down, because it's another way of learning, if you like, the history of art. The image will stay with you, the date may not. And also the connections as well. You can find out that, I don't know, Constable and Rubens were somehow connected.
Or Poussin and Rubens are somehow connected.
Poussin and Rubens.
Because historically, Poussin and Rubens are seen as opposites, with Poussin being the kind of intellectual, disciplined draftsman and Rubens being the much more exuberant expressionist handler of paint. But when you see Kossoff's responses to Rubens and Kossoff's responses to Poussin put alongside one another, you see that he's finding what they've got in common. And what they've got in common is that they create this passionate world that Kossoff is being able to... He's connecting the two of them, which art historians just can't.
Anne Dowker and Colin Wiggins. And if that's inspired you to get out your sketchpad, the gallery runs drawing courses and events for both adults and children. All details can be found on the National Gallery website. Leon Kossoff, Drawing from Painting, runs from the 14th of March to the 1st of July, and entry is free. And now, dahlias. These marvels of the autumn garden were something of a favourite with the Impressionist Auguste Renoir. Still very much in fashion with gardeners today, they've also been delighting visitors to the National Gallery, as Leah Caribbean now reports.
If you've seen the poster for the Renoir landscapes, you won't have failed to notice that it shows a profusion of flowers, not a tasteful selection of pinks and whites arranged in a nice vase, but a riot of red, orange, yellow and purple blooms growing in what appears to be a very overgrown garden. The flowers in question are dahlias, and I'm here in the exhibition with the garden writer and broadcaster Sarah Raven to talk about these wonderful plants. We're standing in front of the picture used on the poster, Renoir's garden in the Rue Courteau in Montmartre, and I wondered, Sarah, if you could actually start by describing what you see. I mean, can you tell which dahlias he's planted?
Yes, I think you can. I mean, I can't identify all of them, but I'm pretty sure that the one right sort of at the heart of the group and at the heart of the painting is a variety called Arabian Night, which is a decorative dahlia. And the reason that that's pretty, I wouldn't say definite, but likely, is that Arabian Night has this absolute characteristic, really dense flower and lovely, rich, dark crimson colouring. And around it, there are others which are more difficult to identify, but I'm pretty sure that they are all in the decorative dahlia group, which is, some would say, the more uptight group. Fashionable at the moment are the really wayward, wacky, sort of punk hairdo type, which are the cactus dahlias, which look like a sort of sea anemone or sea urchin, with lots of spines as the flowers, as the petals, rather. The decorative are neater, tidier, and beautiful, often very textured, very very sort of velvety petals. And all these, I'm pretty sure, are decorative dahlias.
And have they been grown with other plants? Are there other plants in there that you can identify?
Yeah, that's particularly interesting to me, is that in Monet's garden at Giverny, where I actually first saw dahlias and fell in love with dahlias about 15, 20 years ago, he united, and they still have this planting, climbing nasturtiums with dahlias. And I'm pretty sure that this is exactly what we've got here.
And so could I grow a display like this in my own garden?
Yes, very much. And I think, again, one of the things that's happened with climate change is that dahlias have really become one of the lowest maintenance plants that you can grow. What you used to have to do was lift the tubers in the winter, if you were in a frost-prone area, and store them in a barn or wherever over the winter and then replant them again in the spring. Now, I haven't lifted my dahlias in my garden for 10 years, mm-hmm. and they come back bigger and better every year because, of course, you're not disturbing the roots. They're growing a little bit through the winter. So the plants get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and they don't, the tubers don't get frosted. If you have to put a bit of a carpet of sort of something, compost or whatever, over them to insulate them through the winter. But they are unbelievably easy to grow. They're unbelievably generous of flower. They are really worth it. I did a very interesting little experiment from one wonderful dahlia, not unlike Arabian Night, but with slightly bigger flowers, called Rip City, which is a modern bread variety, and I counted how many buckets of flowers I picked through a season from one tuber, and I picked 20 buckets of flowers from one plant. So,
it's money for money, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Sarah Raven. If you plant your dahlias out once the frosts are over, you'll see the results this autumn, so well worth the effort. But if you can't wait till then, you can enjoy Renoir's wonderful dahlias right now. The Renoir Landscape Show runs until the 20th of May and is accompanied by an audio guide featuring the exhibition curators. Please visit www.nationalgallery.org.uk for advance booking. And why not treat yourself to a cream tea in the National Dining Rooms after you've seen the show? And finally, in addition to temporary exhibitions like Kossoff and Renoir, we've also got a magnificent permanent collection of paintings that's completely free to explore. Many of the works on show are hundreds of years old and are often epic in scale. Yet they're all inspired by the same feelings and desires we experience today. In February's episode, we talked about pictures celebrating the ups and downs of love. This month, we take beauty as our theme. I spoke to Leslie Primo from National Gallery Information about two works he's particularly passionate about. Leslie, you work for National Gallery Information, responsible for talking to visitors about the works in the collection. And you're particularly keen about the painting we're standing in front of, aren't you? This is The Judgment of Paris by Peter Paul Rubens.
Yeah, this is a painting I've long had an obsession with, really, and love for. A painting that I used to visit the gallery exclusively to see years before I ever worked here. In fact, I visited a gallery at least once a week to come and see this painting, and I've read so many books about this painting that when I eventually decided to do a degree in history of art, well, I wrote a dissertation about this painting.
So what's actually going on here? We've got The Judgment of Paris, and we've got the three goddesses, Aphrodite or Venus, Minerva or Athene, and Hera or Juno, who were being judged by a rather attractive young man who's holding out a golden apple.
Now, of course, all three goddesses face Paris and are trying to persuade him somehow that they are more beautiful than the other. And what we can see in this picture is, in fact, that they've all resorted to the age-old idea of trying to attract men, and that is to take off your clothes. So they've all taken off their clothes to try and attract Paris's attention. Of course, the problem with this is Paris is, after all, a mere mortal man, and men aren't very good when it comes to making decisions about beautiful women, especially when they're all naked. And what we see in this picture is three women showing us what for Rubens at this time was ideal beauty. But what's great about this is that, of course, these are goddesses, so one would expect from goddesses to see some pretty stunning women, much in the vein of what we'd nowadays call ideal beauty. For instance, we'd look at someone like Paris Hilton with a zero size figure and say, yes, this is ideal beauty. So one would expect that kind of woman here. But that's not what we see here. What we see, in fact, are three very large, voluptuous women with lots of cellulite, lots of rolls of flesh. This is ideal beauty for Rubens in 1632.
Leslie, this painting's just lovely. It's very, very different from the one we were looking at just now. For a start, it's a lot smaller and it's much more kind of carefully worked, isn't it?
Yes, this painting by Joachim Utwal approaches the same story again, The Judgment of Paris, but some 15 years earlier than the painting that we saw, painted around about 1632 by Rubens. So this painting, again, we see the goddesses lined up, but in here, the goddesses' body types are markedly different from what we saw before. They are much more muscular, and in fact, the rolls of fat disappear. We're looking at a completely different body type here now in this particular depiction. But of course, in the middle, we have Paris, and Paris in the middle here actually has given the golden apple to Aphrodite or Venus.
So this, in fact, is giving us the end of the story, isn't it? Which is that because all of the goddesses were equally lovely, and they really are quite stunning in this, they had to offer him bribes, didn't they?
Well, it's essentially that's what's going on here. This really, this Judgment of Paris, although it has a really wonderful art title, is essentially a beauty contest. And all three goddesses have tried to tempt Paris. They have been unable to tempt him, mainly because he's not able to make a decision over three naked women. So instead, what we see is that the goddesses try to bribe him. And we see, first of all, that Hera tries to bribe him with money and jewels, followed by Minerva or Athena. She tries to bribe Paris with strength and wisdom in battle, because that is her attributes. Of course, the bribe that wins over Paris is the bribe from Venus, of course, because Venus offers Paris a great prize, and that is the prize of Helen. And Helen is the most beautiful woman on earth, and of course, instead of taking the money, as I would have done, of course, Paris goes for lust, and that's what really this is about. This is about lust. Lust winning over money and winning over strength and wisdom.
So back then, just as now, perhaps ideas of beauty have proved very divisive indeed.
They have indeed, and ideas of beauty are really what this is all about. What do we consider to be the most perfect body? Is it the voluptuous Rubenesque body? Is it the athletic body of Utval? Or is it the zero size model that we now hold in great esteem? It's really about the society that we live in at the time, and what we've seen with both these artists is the society that they lived in at the time had very different ideas as to what the ideal beauty is. And in fact, the society that we live in now also has different ideas to what the ideal beauty is. It's just that we are unaware of it.
Leslie Primo. You can pop in to admire the three goddesses for yourselves. Rubens' Judgment of Paris is in room 29, and Utevel's version is in room 17. That's all for now, but if you're planning a visit to the gallery this month, there are a number of Easter events you might like to take part in, from live concerts to painting workshops for families. There's also a special Life of Christ audio trail to follow through the galleries. Visit www.nationalgallery.org.uk for details. Don't forget to join us next month, when we'll be coming to you from the National Gallery at night, a special episode celebrating the uncanny world of the art gallery once the doors have closed and the lights are out. Until then, goodbye.